KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
The church that he leads should be seen as what he calls a field hospital for the poor and the marginalized.
As Pope Francis continues to recover, we examine why the papacy matters globally beyond the Catholic Church. For Sunday, March 2nd, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Ahead, European leaders are responding to President Trump's dismissal of Ukraine's president by putting together their own new peace plan. Also, why Mexico turned over dozens of drug cartel leaders to the United States.
Not many people are going to go out and bat for the defense of these kind of criminals who have committed these kind of crimes.
And a NASA telescope gets set to launch this week and has some big objectives.
We're going to see the entire universe four times in our two-year mission. And that means we can draw really grand conclusions from a very large data set.
That and more after this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. At a summit of 20 world leaders in London today, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer said Europe has to do the heavy lifting to secure a lasting peace between Russia and Ukraine, but that the effort also needs the strong backing of the U.S. Starmer says Britain, France, and Ukraine have agreed to work on a ceasefire plan to present to the U.S. Terry Schultz has more.
Now, this is going to require a lot more money, sustained funding, sustained weapons transfers to Ukraine, and eventually, the Europeans say, several countries are willing to put their own troops on the ground to monitor a ceasefire. But there's a big contingency clause here. This will require American help and backup to keep Russia on its side of a ceasefire line. Asked whether he thought Donald Trump would agree to this, Starmer said he'd spoken with Trump last night and would not be moving ahead if he wasn't confident of that.
Terry Schultz reporting. Top Republicans are questioning President Zelensky's leadership of Ukraine following his heated meeting with President Trump at the White House last week. But not all of the GOP is on the same page. NPR's Luke Garrett has more.
House Speaker Mike Johnson of Louisiana threw his support of Zelensky into doubt on Sunday. He told NBC News,
"Either he needs to come to his senses and come back to the table in gratitude, or someone else needs to lead the country to do that."
On Friday, following the tense Trump-Zelensky meeting, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina suggested Zelensky should resign or change. But on Sunday, GOP Senator James Lankford of Oklahoma told NBC News he disagrees.
"I'm not interested in calling on the resignation of other world leaders."
Independent Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont defended Zelensky outright on NBC News.
"Zelensky is leading a country trying to defend democracy against an authoritarian dictator, Putin, who invaded his country."
Luke Garrett, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump signed two executive orders aimed at increasing American lumber production and possibly increasing tariffs on lumber imports. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben reports it's one of a slew of tariffs the Trump administration is currently threatening.
One order directs agencies to find ways to increase lumber production. Another directs the Secretary of Commerce to investigate possible lumber tariffs. The White House says the goal is to reduce the cost of building housing. Tariffs are taxes American businesses pay to import products from abroad. Trump has also threatened tariffs on an array of other goods and countries. Canada accounts for around 40% of American lumber imports, by far the largest of any country. Trump has also threatened blanket 25% tariffs on Canada as well as Mexico, saying those could take effect as early as March 4th. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News, West Palm Beach, Florida.
U.S. futures contracts have slipped into negative territory. Dow futures are down about 0.1%. This is NPR News. A Texas-based company has landed a spacecraft on the moon in a new step for U.S. space exploration. As NPR's Joe Hernandez reports, the lunar lander carried a number of NASA science experiments on board.
The Blue Ghost lunar lander by the American company Firefly Aerospace touched down on the moon early Sunday morning. The mission is part of a NASA program to contract with private space companies to deliver scientific instruments and other payloads to the moon. Included on the Blue Ghost lander are a device to collect rock samples from the lunar surface and an X-ray imager to study Earth's magnetic field. The successful touchdown came after several attempts by other private companies to land on the moon in recent years. Blue Ghost's landing capped a 45-day journey covering more than 2.8 million miles. Joe Hernandez, NPR News.
At the weekend box office, Captain America: Brave New World took the top spot once again with an estimated $15 million in ticket sales. The Anthony Mackie-led film has made $163 million since its release, but it has been slammed by many critics and audiences for failing to bring the Marvel reset some had hoped for. In second place, The Last Breath, with just $7 million. The film, based on a true story adventure, is about a routine deep-sea diving mission that goes terribly wrong when a young diver is stranded some 300 feet below the surface. And in third place, The Monkey, with $6 million. I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
Fratelli e sorelle.
Brothers and sisters, Jesus Christ is risen. He alone has the power to roll away the stone that blocked the path of life.
That's Pope Francis speaking last Easter from the St. Peter's balcony overlooking Vatican Square. He was delivering an Urbi et Orbi, his Easter blessing. The moment and the setting encapsulates the thousands of years of ritual and pageantry associated with the Catholic Church.
Annuncio vobis, gaudium magnum, habemus papam.
The balcony of the ornate St. Peter's Basilica is the same spot where some 12 years ago, Jorge Mario Bergoglio was introduced to the world as Pope Francis I.
Fratelli e sorelle, buonasera.
But that setting also regularly showcases another aspect of the role Francis and his predecessors have played, world leader.
In calling for respect for the principles of international law, I express my hope for a general exchange of all prisoners between Russia and Ukraine, all for the sake of all.
That's another moment from Francis's March 2024 Easter blessing. As war raged between Ukraine and Russia, Hamas and Israel.
I appeal once again access to humanitarian aid be ensured to Gaza and call once more for the prompt release of the hostages seized on 7 October last and for an immediate ceasefire in the Strip.
Francis hasn't just focused on war, though. He has repeatedly tried to point the world's attention to two ongoing challenges. Immigration.
Es scandalosa la exclusión de inmigrantes.
The exclusion of migrants is scandalous. Indeed, it's criminal.
Anzi.
It makes them die in front of us. And so today the Mediterranean is the world's largest cemetery. The exclusion of migrants is disgusting. It is sinful.
And climate change.
This requires us, all of us, to face a choice. The choice between continuing to ignore the suffering of the poorest and to abuse our common home, the planet, or engaging at every level to transform the way we act.
And those statements echo those of his predecessors on other issues. Pope John Paul II, a son of Poland, worked to bring an end to communism.
A decisive factor in the success of those nonviolent revolutions was the experience of social solidarity in the face of regimes baked by the power of propaganda and terror, a beacon of hope and an enduring reminder that it is possible for man's historical journey to follow a path which is true to the finest aspirations of the human spirit.
And his successor, Pope Benedict XVI, regularly work to reduce global inequality.
Human rights are more often presented as a common language and the ethic underpinning of international relations.
Much of the world has spent the past 2 weeks focused on Pope Francis's health, and the reason why has as much to do with the fact that he is a powerful geopolitical force as it does with the fact he's a key religious figure. To dig into the reasons why, we spoke to Colgate political science professor Tim Burns.
Looking at Pope Francis's papacy, what are the through lines you draw through of when he did decide to use this diplomatic power, this soapbox that he has?
Yeah, well, I think I would make a distinction, if I could, between the two.
Okay.
In the sense that he uses his diplomatic powers formally and legally in certain ways that I'll get to in a moment. But when it comes to his sort of soft power, moral megaphone, leader of the Catholic Church and sort of religious spokesman, I think he's made it pretty clear over the course of his papacy that he wants to direct the interests of the church and whatever authority he has as the church's leader towards certain issues that he defines in certain ways. And the clearest one of those is his reaction to climate change. He defines climate change as a moral issue, where what he calls the marginalized of society who suffer the most from the ravages of climate change have played the least role in bringing it about. So I think he wants to, in identifying himself and his church with what he calls the people at the margins, he looks for issues like climate change to say, this is not a scientific problem, this is a moral problem, and he really wants to put it at the foot of the industrialized world to say, you have caused this problem, these people are suffering because of it, what are you going to do about it?
So then when I first asked the question, you said you wanted to take them separately. Let's talk about specific diplomacy, because there are also examples of Pope Francis acting in a diplomatic way, whether it was brokering deals between the United States and Cuba or other examples.
Yeah, I think the example of Cuba is a very, very good one, because it shows that only he, really only he, could play that kind of role in total secrecy and using formally the diplomatic pouch of the Holy See to communicate or to mediate communications between Raul Castro and Barack Obama. Not only in the kind of, well, we can trust the Pope not to reveal our secrets, but to actually have diplomatic pouch and communication that could go through the Holy See. But that's only a kind of a most obvious example. When Julian Assange released WikiLeaks, there was a whole tranche of documents that came to be called VADA leaks, where it showed that institutions like the U.S. State Department, across a number of presidential administrations, were actually in far more constant and deep interaction with the Holy See than I think people like me thought they were. Just addressing all kinds of issues that was thought to be of shared interest between the church and the U.S. government, where the church could, as I think it was the Bush administration said, use their moral voice at the UN and in diplomatic terms, where we could be more sort of straightforwardly political about it. So there weren't examples where, you know, this outcome was different than that outcome necessarily because the Pope or the Holy See weighed in, but they're very much involved in things involving poverty, war and peace, what this Pope calls gender ideology, which would be sort of one of their conservative bents. They were very deeply involved in international UN conferences on women, on family planning, etc. So they sort of have a seat at the table that no other religious institution or really no other NGO could even aspire to.
How has Pope Francis's approach to global politics differed from the way that John Paul II approached this?
Well, I think his emphases have been different, and I think the sort of shorthand and a way simplistic way would be to say that John Paul II was Karol Wojtyła of Poland and Francis I is Jorge Bergoglio of Argentina. So they have different sort of political emphases. John Paul II much more interested in the Cold War, and Francis much more interested in this kind of identification of the church with the marginalized in the ways that I think he became famous for articulating in Argentina. The other thing that's different, though, and it intersects, as I said before, with the leadership of the church, John Paul II was not only comfortable with, but aggressively sought a kind of personal identification of the Catholic Church with him, where Francis has expressed his kind of interest in synodality, as he calls it, where he calls these meetings to Rome, and laypersons, clergy, bishops, etc., have been discussing with him issues facing the church. It doesn't mean that he listens to them or that he changes church's practice based upon what they say, but he's not constantly traveling to other countries, constantly asserting himself as the leadership of the church in every one of his institutional contexts.
Let me go back to Pope Francis one more time. We talked about a wide range of different approaches that he's taken to global politics, international relations. What to you of these last 12 years is the most significant thing that Pope Francis did in this field?
For me, it's this idea that the church that he leads should be seen as what he calls a field hospital for the poor and the marginalized. Whether he's always succeeded in that, whether he's been able to successfully direct the entire church, both in Rome and outside of Rome, in that direction. But this is where he gets his strong positions on climate change and migrants, that he believes that the church ought to be associated with those people. The church ought to be using its resources, both financial, institutional, and this enormous soft power resource that he claims, to be focused on the marginalized and the poor, and that every issue that comes along ought to be worked through that frame. I think that's what he decided the day he became Pope, and I think that has been his agenda throughout. Now, there have been problems with that, one being that he leads a very large, complicated church with its own institutional resistance to him. Mm-hmm. So he finds himself in a kind of a particularly difficult position within the church and speaking from the church. But I'd have no doubt that that's what he thinks that his legacy ought to be, that those have been his emphases.
That's political science professor Tim Burns. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Well, thank you for having me.
This is NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Israel is facing sharp criticism from the UN and other humanitarian aid providers over its decision to stop the entry of all food and other supplies into Gaza. Israel says it wants a U.S. proposed ceasefire extension through Ramadan and Passover. Hamas says it's committed to the original ceasefire, which calls for a second phase. A federal judge is blocking President Trump from firing the head of a federal watchdog agency. U.S. District Judge Amy Berman Jackson issued a permanent injunction this weekend, saying Hampton Dellinger must keep his job. And at the weekend box office, Captain America: Brave New World took the top spot once again with an estimated $15 million in ticket sales. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Cy Sims Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Israel has stopped the entry of all goods and supplies into the Gaza Strip. The move comes amid fragile negotiations after the first of a planned three-phase ceasefire expired Saturday. Earlier today, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said there will be, quote, additional consequences if Hamas does not agree to a temporary extension by releasing more hostages. But in a statement today, Hamas accused Israel of evading the initial framework of the ceasefire plan. At the center of this back and forth is Egypt, where mediators met this past week to hammer out this new phase. And with us to explain what is going on behind the scenes is NPR's Aya Batrawi. Hello.
Hi.
So you spent time in Cairo this past week talking to officials. Tell us what you have learned about Egypt's role in all of this.
Well, Egypt is in a unique position. It was the first Arab country to make peace with Israel nearly 46 years ago, and that was after it had fought wars with Israel. So Egypt has decades of experience talking to, mediating, negotiating with Israel, and it also talks directly with Hamas and other Palestinian factions. Second, Egypt directly borders Gaza and Israel, so it has a stake in what happens there, and it's impacted by the instability around it. Another key factor here, Scott, is that Egypt has the knowledge, the manpower, the experience, and the minds to come up with ideas and strategies that the Arab states can get behind. And Egypt has traditionally done this, and it's doing so now, even as we're seeing with its mediation in the ceasefire in Gaza.
One of the biggest developments since this initial deal went into place is President Trump coming into office and then saying that he wants to see Gaza's 2 million Palestinians permanently relocated to countries like Egypt and Jordan. He wants to turn Gaza into a beachfront real estate project. How concerned are Egyptians about all of that?
Everyone I spoke to in Egypt says this would be deeply destabilizing. They say it's a bad idea, basically. Any displacement of Palestinians, whether forced or voluntary, into Egypt is a red line for Egypt. It's a national security breach. I spoke with Nabil Fahmy. He was Egypt's ambassador to the U.S., and he served as foreign minister of Egypt. He tells me about another concern Egypt has.
The idea that, well, Israel is strong enough today with Western support, and so they can push them into Jordan or push them into Egypt, is a non-starter for us. It would also, frankly, very seriously impinge on our peace agreement.
So basically what Fahmy is saying here is that if Israel believes it's strong enough to push people off the land, what's to stop them from doing so into the Sinai Peninsula or Egypt? So that's why Egypt is also building up its defenses in this territory now as a precaution. So again, the view here is that Trump's plan could draw Egypt into a direct conflict with Israel, upending the peace accords and security in the region.
So has Egypt offered an alternative plan, though?
Yeah, I mean, it has actually several plans along several tracks. The first is basic reconstruction. You have tens of thousands of Palestinians killed in Gaza, more than 90% of homes damaged or destroyed. Basic infrastructure there needs to be rebuilt. So this plan looks at how do you repurpose the rubble, how do you bring in temporary homes for Palestinians to live in, and other technical details. And a copy obtained by NPR for one of Egypt's plans under reviews estimates that construction could cost $50 to $80 billion. Now, this multi-phased plan that Egypt is drafting will be presented to leaders of Arab League states converging in Cairo on Tuesday, and I'm told by diplomats in the meeting that Arab states will unite around Egypt's reconstruction plans for Gaza with Palestinians staying on the land. That part is key. Now, other plans Egypt is drafting look at broader issues of governance, like a temporary Palestinian Authority to administer Gaza that does not include Hamas. Police in Gaza would be retrained to provide security. And a reformed Palestinian Authority, which governs parts of the West Bank at the moment, could come in and then also govern Gaza at some point down the line.
You would need so much international cooperation, though. The Gulf Arab states, the U.S., Israel. How does Egypt get these plans off the ground?
Exactly. This is really difficult stuff. But Egypt says it has to keep doing this, has to keep working and formulating these ideas because there's no alternative to peace. And they say that peace can only be achieved if you establish a Palestinian state. So all the plans now being drafted in Cairo are seen as a starting point for what could be eventually down the line an actual Palestinian-Israeli peace process. And I met with Abdelmenem Said Ali. He heads the advisory board of the Regional Center for Security Studies in Cairo. And he says Egypt is taking the lead in formulating these ideas for a way out of the crisis.
We are builders. I mean, Egyptians are builders from the pyramids until now. We need to have a plan of our own, not waiting for Mr. Trump to do it.
So in other words, he says like this, there's a fire in Egypt's neighborhood and Egyptians have to work to try to put it out so it doesn't spread. And so Egypt's working with other Arab states like Saudi Arabia. And this Arab League summit in Cairo on Tuesday is basically the Arab states saying they can come up with solutions and on their own and maybe even a pathway for peace.
That is NPR's Aya Batrawi with her reporting from Cairo. Thanks for bringing it to us.
Thanks, Scott.
Now to Syria. Many things have changed there since the regime of Bashar al-Assad fell in December. NPR's Jane Arraf climbed on board the victory train in Damascus. It was once a propaganda tool for the former Syrian leader, and now it's something very different.
This square in central Damascus is a bit grim on a winter's day. There's a chill in the air. Fading posters of missing people, gray skies. But all of a sudden, like an apparition, a bright, shiny, battered vehicle pulls up.
This might be one of the coolest things I've ever seen. It's like, imagine a children's train. It's covered with pictures of like emojis and cartoons. There's a Smurf. And bright flashing lights.
The engine pulls two open-air compartments with benches. The bright red vehicle is flying the Syrian flag the country switched to after the fall of the regime. The driver is scowling and chain-smoking. We climb on board. The seats are ragged, and there's a big hole in the metal roof. But the music is so exuberant, none of that matters. Raise your head, you're a free Syrian. This is the unofficial anthem of a large part of this new Syria. When Bashar al-Assad's repressive regime fell, it's as if a spell had been broken. Driving past his former hilltop palace, the driver plays a song comparing Bashar to a donkey. It rhymes in Arabic. As we roll along playing anti-Assad songs, a group of people at a sidewalk cafe get up to dance. The man who built and drives this train is Majid Zawadi. He has a grizzled grain beard and he's wearing a black knit watch cap. At a stop, Zawadi tells us that decades ago he bought a used car engine and built the train entirely by hand around it. He plastered it with cartoon characters and images of the Syrian president and his wife to prove his loyalty. A propaganda vehicle, if you will. It was a trick so the police wouldn't arrest me, he says. I'm from Duma and I was afraid. Duma was where Assad used chemical weapons against Syrian citizens, including some of Zawada's relatives. The police arrested Zawada anyway after he accidentally played an anti-Assad song. He was released after a few days and allowed to drive the train again. But as punishment, they destroyed an amusement park he owned. The day after the regime fell, no longer afraid of arrest, he ripped down all the propaganda posters. He's 74 years old and he still has big plans for what he calls the victory train. I want you to see this 2 months from now, he says. I don't have money now, but it will have smoke like a real train. I want the whole world to see it. A lot of the passengers are Syrian tourists, like Rafael Ahmed, a car dealer from Deir Ezzor. He and his wife, Qamar, are visiting Damascus for the first time in 13 years. We're happy because of the fall of the regime. We're enjoying ourselves, Qamar says. The train pulls out again. Zoueida, the driver, stern-looking, but happier, he says, than he's ever been. A free citizen driving around this free Syria. Jane Araf, NPR News, Damascus.
This past week, Mexico transferred 29 prominent cartel figures into U.S. custody. Attorney General Pam Bondi says the Justice Department intends to prosecute them for crimes including drug trafficking, homicide, and organized crime. The group of prisoners includes men believed to be leaders or capos. They're some of Mexico's most violent cartels, including Los Zetas and the Sinaloa cartel. So what does this move tell us about U.S.-Mexico relations when it comes to dealing with illicit drugs? Joan Grillo is a journalist covering crime and drugs in Mexico City and is author of the book El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Let's start with this. Tell us about some of these nearly 30 cartel leaders who have been handed over to the U.S.
It's really an immense hit on cartels. These are major players, right from the former heads of the Zetas. These were people who were accused of being involved in crimes like the mass disappearance of more than 400 people in one town whose bodies were dissolved in metal barrels. Also among the prisoners is Rafael Caro Quintero, who's accused in the murder of a DEA agent back in the 1980s. And what's amazing about this mass extradition, I mean, this was came as a surprise. We were covering it and we got kind of a whiff in the morning something was happening, and then we didn't understand the scale, is that the Mexican government totally trampled on their extradition processes and their appeals. Normally there'd be an extradition process and these things can last years. This was just an express, and they even say it's not quite extradition, it's expulsion. They're trying to find a legal backing for this, which is hard to find convincing.
Yeah.
At the same time, not many people are going to go out and back for the defense of these kind of criminals who have committed these kind of crimes.
Is it fair to say from what you've seen so far that there is broad approval then for this action in Mexico City throughout the rest of Mexico?
Yes, I my sense is, I mean, the president right now has an 80% approval rating, and my sense is that regular people, the broad public, are going to be very supportive of this move.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the criticism is coming more from certain, you know, a few journalists who are concerned about the legality of this. Some figures involved in human rights or involved in, you know, legal proceedings, some lawyers, and this is breaking the law, and that creates a dangerous precedent where whatever these people have done, if you start breaking the law and just expelling them to the United States without an extradition process, then that opens the door to the government doing more things breaking the law.
What does this tell you about what Shane Baum's broader goals are when it comes to dealing with the U.S., dealing with President Trump right now?
So President Sheinbaum came into power on October the 1st and has a massive challenge with President Trump and the threat of tariffs, the threat of military action. And she seems to be handling it very well. She has a pressure at home of not bowing too much to Trump, of not being seen too much of just doing whatever he says. At the same time, she has to handle Trump in a diplomatic way, and we've seen with other leaders, you know, it can be a very hard president to handle. She seems to be doing it very well. I would say we can see very clearly Mexico is making a priority, and it has done this for years, of maintaining that trade relationship, because Mexico is the biggest trading partner to the United States. It's bigger than Canada and it's bigger than China. There's more than $1 trillion of trade between the two countries. So maintaining that. Now, she's also looking to avoid unilateral military action by the United States and looking more to show we can be a partner in fighting cartels. There are drones run by the CIA, spy drones going across Mexico. We've had information of that. But they are currently getting information and giving it to the Mexican security forces who are making raids. The head of the Mexican military said these were used in high-level raids in the state of Sinaloa last week, and some of those people who were arrested, lieutenants of the Chapitos faction of the Sinaloa cartel, were involved in the same people of extradition sent to the United States. So with U.S. information from U.S. spy planes in Mexico, captured by the Mexican military, and then handed to the U.S. without an extradition process. So really working with the U.S., the tricky thing is the U.S. working with the Mexican military, Mexican security services, we've seen time and time again, there's corruption. And so you have the U.S. working with people who are, you know, some figures who are working with drug traffickers. But this seems to be that the strategy is pushing and forcing the cartels to reduce the flow of fentanyl and reduce the trafficking or the smuggling of migrants into the United States.
That is journalist Johan Grillo. Thank you so much.
Great to be here.
This is NPR News. President Trump wants Greenland. He says the U.S. should control what is now an autonomous territory of Denmark for, quote, national security purposes. The leaders of Denmark and Greenland, though, say the island is not for sale. But what do people on the island make of this? All Things Considered co-host Juana Summers traveled to Greenland to find out.
Lila Sandgren is a masterful multitasker. When we meet her, she's typing away as we talk inside the tourism company she owns with her husband.
You are busy. He said you wear a lot of hats. He's not kidding.
Not kidding.
There are earrings and carvings spread out on the desk in front of her. She wants to sell them to future tourists. And right now, there is a lot of international attention on Greenland.
This is not first time we have heard about the President Donald Trump. He always wants to buy Greenland.
Sandgren was born and raised in Ilulissat, the small town that is one of Greenland's most popular tourist destinations. Even though she wants more people to come here, including Americans, she doesn't want the island to be part of America.
We want to be Greenlanders. We don't want to be American. We don't want to be Danish. We only want to be Greenlandic people. We want to be Inuit.
That notion was repeated over and over again in our conversations with local residents. A recent poll from Danish and Greenlandic news outlets found that 85% of Greenlanders don't want to be a part of the United States.
We want to be independent, so we are not for sale.
This is Karen Kortzen. She owns a hair salon just down the road.
Something like European or American, we're not used to it because we are very calm, so we are not so interested.
Trump has been making the case for the U.S. to acquire Greenland since his first term. He and his allies point to Greenland's strategic location, as well as its reserves of rare earth minerals. In Nuuk, we sat down with Jorgen Boesen, who is a Greenlandic fan of President Trump.
I think U.S. is more welcome than to have a base, more bases here, and have a military to protect U.S. and Greenland to Russia and China. So I have no trouble with that.
The U.S. already has a military base specializing in missile defense at the remote northern end of the island. Boesen says he hopes for a free association agreement where the U.S. gives Greenland economic assistance and provides for defense. It's not yet clear what shape, if any, Trump's ambitions will take. We meet Mala Johnson at the streetwear company he owns in Nuuk, and here the welcoming of international influences is again clear. His company is called Bolt Lamar, named for the famed Jamaican sprinter Usain Bolt and the American musician Kendrick Lamar.
What do you hope for the future of your country?
To me, the optimal solution would be if we became an independent country, but with partnerships. If we should do this the right way, we should always have a relationship with Denmark, as we share a history. It's like almost like family.
And of a future relationship with the U.S.?
I think the most important thing here is to respect every different culture and the people in that culture, and not to colonize the place all over again.
Juana Summers, NPR News, Greenland.
And for more of Juana's in-depth reporting from Greenland, you can head over to npr.org. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
One of the top foreign policy challenges President Trump must confront during this second term is a country analysts believe is close to developing a nuclear weapon, Iran.
There's two ways of stopping them, with bombs or with a written piece of paper.
That story on the next morning edition from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. At a summit of 20 world leaders in London today, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer said Europe has to do the heavy lifting to secure a lasting peace between Russia and Ukraine, but that the effort also needs the strong backing of the United States. Elon Musk is facing a backlash over his efforts to downsize the federal government on President Trump's behalf. Protesters turned out at several Tesla dealerships this weekend, including in Boston, Jacksonville, and Tucson, and nine demonstrators were arrested in New York City. And a private space company based in Texas put its Blue Ghost lander on the moon this morning. The lander from Firefly Aerospace carried a drill, a vacuum, and other experiments for NASA. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Luminescence Foundation, dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. From Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. More funding and weapons for Ukraine and for their own defense. These are the priorities a group of European and NATO countries agreed on today at an emergency meeting in London in the presence of Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Terry Schultz reports on the four-point plan.
UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer declared the emergency summit he hosted in London came at a make-or-break moment.
We are at a crossroads in history today. This is not a moment for more talk. It's time to act, time to step up and lead, and to unite around a new plan for a just and enduring peace.
Starmer and French President Emmanuel Macron, seated at the front of the room alongside Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, must have been keenly aware of how delicate their diplomatic maneuvering had become after Friday's White House meeting between Zelensky and President Donald Trump disintegrated in front of the cameras, with Trump berating the Ukrainian leader for what he said was gambling with World War III. The European leaders wanted to show they will not abandon Kyiv. After all, for many, Ukraine is the buffer zone between Russian President Vladimir Putin's troops and their territory. The Starmer-Macron plan is to bring to Trump a European version of a roadmap to achieve and sustain peace between Ukraine and Russia, rather than a Trump-generated concept, which they fear would give the Kremlin too many concessions. It starts with bolstering Ukraine with more money and military support, both for a better negotiating position with Moscow and for the long run. This is how European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen described those aspirations as she left the meeting.
We have to put Ukraine in a position of strength, that it has the means to fortify and protect itself from the economic survival to the military resilience. It's basically turning Ukraine into a steel porcupine that is indigestible for potential invaders.
One tricky part of this deal would be satisfying Trump's demand that a reassurance force to monitor and envision ceasefire would be made up of European troops, no Americans. Starmer was the first to say UK forces and air power could be part of it, but there's a big contingency clause for him and every other leader considering this action.
To succeed, this effort must have strong US backing. We're working with the U.S. on this point.
Starmer says he's been in touch with Trump as recently as Saturday about this, and that he wouldn't be pushing the idea forward if he didn't think he could get U.S. guarantees. This could mean the use of American intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance capabilities for troops and the positioning of U.S. warplanes close to Ukraine to respond in case of a Russian attack. There's another emergency meeting coming up on Thursday when European Union leaders gather in Brussels to try to find the money to spend more on Ukraine and on their own defense. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
Here are a couple existential questions for you. How did we get here? How did the universe begin? How did galaxies develop? Well, soon scientists may have more answers to some of these questions, and that is because on Tuesday, NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory is scheduled to launch a new 8.5-foot-tall telescope called Sphere X, and its goal is to explore the origin of the universe and all the essential ingredients of life itself. So no pressure. Joining me to talk about this is Sphere X Deputy Project Manager Beth Fabinski. Beth, welcome.
Thank you so much.
I wanted to start with a clarification because I think, you know, the James Webb Telescope has gotten so much attention in recent years and has been sending these phenomenal images and providing these new understandings. What is different and unique here about Sphere X?
The main difference between the wonderful Webb Telescope and Sphere X is that Sphere X is an all-sky survey and it has a very wide field of view. We're going to see the entire universe four times in our two-year mission. And that means we can draw really grand conclusions from a very large data set about the universe that we see.
Can you just help somebody who's listening and maybe not fully following along? Like what the key difference is compared to some of the space telescopes we're used to hearing about?
Yes, absolutely. So one of the main features of Sphere X is that we do spectroscopy. So we're going to see the entire sky in over 100 infrared colors. And that's something that has not been done before. So an all-sky spectral survey means we see every point on the sky in these 102 colors four times during our mission. And that's an exciting data set that astronomers and astrophysicists will have to work with.
How are you feeling right now? Because these missions are planned out so intricately, so many years in advance, so many things have to go right. What does it feel like in your position a few days before a hopeful launch?
It's very exciting and it's very terrifying because it's the culmination of so many people's hard work, late nights, long hours. And of course, something could go wrong. Space is hard.
Can you walk us through what's going to happen over the next few days? Just the broad plan of attack of what needs to be set up before the telescope starts sending you back results.
Well, first we have to launch. And we have to roll out our spacecrafts along with its partner mission. We're co-manifest with another mission called Punch. And we have to roll out to the rocket pad so that we can launch up into our Earth orbit. And while the team at the launch site is getting ready for that, and they're working very, very hard, I have to shout out to them. Meanwhile, back at Jet Propulsion Lab, our operations team is doing last-minute preparations to hear from the spacecraft once it's in orbit. That's going to be a very exciting moment when we first hear from it in space.
Assuming everything goes right, how quickly do you start getting data back?
We're going to start our science survey about 5 to 6 weeks after we launch. So it's a little over a month to check out the spacecraft. And then we start collecting data and we release that data shortly after for the science community to use.
What are you most excited about here? You know, I started out with all these big philosophical theoretical questions and hopefully this will help provide some new information about some of them. Is there anything in particular that you're really interested to see with this wide scope?
We're looking at the first moments in the universe during a period called cosmic inflation. I'm very excited about that. We're looking at the evolution of galaxies over time. That's also exciting. And our final main science objective is to look inside our galaxy for the signature of ices in dense clouds of gas and dust. And that's pretty exciting too. So our science objectives definitely make me excited, and I'm also excited for the unknown things that will be discovered.
And I assume you'll probably be a little more excited once everything goes well Tuesday.
I will be much more excited if things are successful, definitely.
That's Beth Favinsky, the Deputy Project Manager for SphereX. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
As a cast member on Saturday Night Live, Bowen Yang has had a bunch of memorable roles, including the iceberg that sank the Titanic, doing PR damage control.
Well, everyone's talking about me. No one's talking about the water. What did the autopsy say? They icebergged it? No. They drowned. That's not me. That's water.
Not too bad for a guy who thought SNL wouldn't cast him when he originally sent in his audition tape.
I was like, yeah, I'll do it on a lark because there's no way they're ever going to hire for camera this effeminate Asian man. And I was just throwing everything against the wall, being like, this is for me. This is not for them. I don't think this will be seen.
He obviously got the job. And now Bowen Yang's fame extends beyond SNL. And the question of how he grapples with that level of success is one of the subjects that came up when he joined my colleague Rachel Martin for a game of Wild Card. That's NPR's new show where guests choose questions at random from a deck of cards. Questions that get to the heart of how they make sense of the world. Here's Rachel.
Round one, memories. In this round, we're looking back at things that have shaped you, people, experiences. Okay?
Okay.
So, I've three cards in front of me. You pick one, two, or three.
I'm going to go with three.
What was a moment when you felt proud of yourself as a kid?
Oh, wow. I remember in the first grade, or year one as we called it in Canada, I was in Montreal at the time. Mm-hmm. There was just a class one day in school where we drew. It was just like unstructured, like drawing time, right? First grade classic stuff. I drew a clown with blue hair, a flower in his shirt, standing outside the circus. And then there was a speech bubble on the clown, and he was saying, allô, your French Quebecois greeting, allô. Pretty simple stuff, right? But apparently, the teacher at the time thought it was so sophisticated that she, like, submitted it to this art contest. And then I won a full $20 Canadian. And it was the first, I think it was a pretty vital moment of, like, creative validation for me growing
totally.
Up. Yeah. And my parents were very excited, and I got $20.
Did your parents think you were going to be an artist, or you just moved on from that?
No, they really pushed that. And for some reason, art was, like, acceptable creative outlets mm-hmm. for mm-hmm. an Asian child of immigrants.
It was the high arts. The high arts, yes.
It was the high arts. Right. And so I think they were very confused when I pivoted years later to improv comedy and, like, telling jokes on stage because they were like, this is completely crude.
Yeah, I think it's a good fit.
Thanks.
Just saying. I think it all worked out the way it was supposed to. We are now in round two, okay?
Great.
In this round, we're focused on insights, what you're learning. Three new cards. One, two, three.
Let's go with three.
What have you learned to be careful about?
This is, like, really something that I've dwelled on for the past, 2-3 months. Tina Fey came on my podcast, and she, in a very playful, so brilliant way, was railing against me for sharing my real opinions on movies on the podcast. But basically what Tina was saying was, this is a permanent record. It's like that thing of, like, the internet is written in permanent marker. And the phrase that kind of, like, went a little viral from that was her saying, authenticity is dangerous and expensive. Mm-hmm. And I really am still reckoning with that idea where I'm like, I've always been an open book. I've always shared my thoughts pretty extemporaneously on things and haven't really regretted them too much. But now I think I'm reevaluating what it means or, like, how worth it is to, like, be honest about everything. But then at the same time, like, if you kind of start to self-censor a bit, then, like, what does that do to your idea of yourself?
It's hard. I mean, it's not like, woe is you, your life is so
hard. No, not at all.
But being in the public spotlight, it forces you to figure that out. I think that's what Tina Fey was saying, right? Like, you might want to work with these people someday.
Sure. But I think I'm applying that to everything. It's about, like, my own, the way I mull things over just out loud and how,
yeah,
and how like the idea that people are listening or watching is so overwhelming if I think about it for too long.
Yeah. Well, and also, Bowen, you have to keep some things for yourself. Totally. Not everybody, including me, is entitled to all your things.
There you go.
Round three.
Okay.
Beliefs. Okay, three new cards. One, two, three.
Let's go with two.
Two. Do you think there's more to reality than we can see or touch?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I am generally a skeptic with things. I read too many Carl Sagan books in college, but I feel like there is this meta reality or something that exists that people can tap into, because like I know the question is not necessarily implying anything supernatural, but we had on a medium for the podcast.
We can go supernatural all day long.
Great. Amazing. This guy was pretty good. Tyler Henry. He's also known to some people as the Hollywood medium. And again, like it invites skepticism because you're like, how much did he know beforehand? And he said things to me that really were like really conceptual and not necessarily, oh, this person is in this other dimension and they're trying to communicate this to you. For me, it was just like, oh, what I'm picking up from you is that like you have this legacy of people who were not able to like share their lives, or like the legacy is a little bit blurred. My dad grew up in a rural part of China where most of his relatives are not really documented. There was just no family tree or history to sort of go off of, and no one could read and no one went to school, and he was the first in his family to even go to college. And so what Tyler Henry was basically saying was like, you are able to sort of like end this cycle of one, shame, and two, record in a weird way. Like you get to sort of like, through being yourself and being like a citizen of this world now where people are like constantly tracking things and things are easily recorded for posterity, like that gets to sort of be like one of your sort of like motivating forces in life. And that's something that like I kind of loved hearing. Like it was very meaningful to hear because it was borrowed from this like metaphysical space, but at the same time it applies to something that I can do now, and it is from a reality that is unobservable, which I kind of love. Yeah.
That's Saturday Night Live cast member Bowen Yang talking to Rachel Martin. You can hear more from that conversation on the Wildcard Podcast. Sunday, that is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Thank you for listening. Have a great night. We will talk to you again soon.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
I sat with a girl in the moonlight. Her eyes were so big and so black. I still feel the kick that she gave me, 'cause I put my hand on her.
Sweet violet, sweeter than all the roses, covered all over from head to foot.